And now for something completely different.
This is the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Let's do it.
Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. With you till 3 on this Thursday. With plenty to do over the next few hours as we come to you from the road at the Southern Conference Baseball Tournament. With a little bit of a day off here in between games. And we got plenty to do over the next few hours. Coming up, we'll react to what we saw in the NBA playoffs last night. Plus, we were not on the air yesterday, so the all-NBA teams have been announced. A few thoughts on that and what it means for the future of the NBA. We'll talk about Arch Manning. Reports are he's nailed it down to 3 schools, and I'll tell you which one he should pick coming up later on this hour. Plus, quite the story with Javon Kinlaw. We got to get to that as best as we can. It's not really radio-friendly, but we'll try to navigate those waters to the best of our ability. Lane Kiffin with some comments on name, image, and likeness, as that's a conversation and a story that certainly won't be going away anytime soon. A ridiculous win last night for the Braves, where it looked like the Phillies had no interest in trying to win the game. And plus, we got to get to the worst fan bases in sports. Why Sam Darnold and Trevor Lawrence are very similar, but Justin Fields is the opposite. I'll get into that later on this afternoon. And Deshaun Watson as well. HBO Real Sports did a sit-down interview with a couple of the accusers of Deshaun Watson the other night. Again, we were not on the air yesterday. We'll react to that from Tuesday night with some of the sound from that whole situation coming up later on this afternoon, as well as we continue to wait on some sort of verdict from the NFL when it comes to Deshaun. So we got a lot to do. All right, been off. We were not on the air yesterday, so I got to make up for some lost time. Plenty of things to get to over the next couple of hours with it till 3. And you can always join the conversation. Get to us online at charlestonsportsradio.com. Click on our show page. You can leave a comment for the show there. You can find the latest versions of the show podcasted right there. Or you can even take the Morrow Midday Show with you wherever you go. Online at charlestonsportsradio.com. You can also get to us on Twitter at Morrow Middays, via email studio@kirkmanbroadcasting.com. You can always text the show 843-608-1734 or get to us on the phones 843-721-9500 to join the conversation. With you till 3 on this Thursday. We also, on a throwback Thursday, we got to talk about some remade movies, because one, a sequel came out this week and it is all the buzz. But on the steel wheels as always, Trent's with us. Trent, what's going on? How are you?
Luke, I'm doing all right. Last night, incredibly disappointing performance by the Miami Heat. Great defense on both ends. But, you know, it's tough, Luke. I'm kind of realizing that the season is winding down a little bit. So the emotions are running high for good old Trent Corville today. But I'm glad to be with you here, sir, on this beautiful Thursday. Hope you're doing well as I'm on my lonesome here in the studio.
Yeah, I'm unfortunately, for better or worse, I have to look at a TV today instead of your beautiful face. So I get to see, I'm looking at Stephen A. Smith right now ranting about your Miami Heat on TV. We're in Greenville for the Southern Conference Baseball Tournament. Bad weather today. It is actually raining today, so good move by the Southern Conference. They figured it's going to be hard to play some games on Thursday, so they moved all the Thursday games to yesterday. We had a Citadel doubleheader. The Citadel won the first game. They lost last night in brutal fashion. They were up 6-3 in the ninth inning and let it slip away and allowed a walk-off to UNCG in the bottom of the ninth. UNCG won 7-6, so that was brutal. But the good news is, by winning the first game yesterday for the Citadel, they're in the double elimination portion of the bracket. So they'll play tomorrow night, probably around 8 o'clock. It's scheduled for 7:30, but we know the problem with baseball. In fact, yesterday, before I dive into all the different topics today, I am, of course, a huge baseball guy. I love baseball. It was a lot of fun yesterday. I spent over 12 hours at the ballpark yesterday. It took me back to my minor league baseball days. The Citadel started before 9 a.m.
Didn't get out of there until after 8 last night. There's still another game going on. It's fantastic. I love it. I went up on the Green Monster to watch the game in between. It was a well-pitched game. It was 4-1. Western Carolina, VMI, that game took about 4 hours. Between the pitching changes, we had like an injury delay at some point. We had multiple reviews. I was sitting there thinking, my goodness. I was looking at the clock wondering, you know, when we were going to have to go on the air. I had to time out my work schedule yesterday to get ready for our second broadcast. And following along on that game, it took over an hour just to do the first two innings. People don't complain. I've always said, I don't think you complain about the length of the baseball game. If it's intriguing, you'll watch it. It's the lack of inaction. It took over an hour to go two innings, and it's not like we were getting a lot of runs either. Different pitching changes, mound visits, reviews. So, point being, the Citadel, they're scheduled to play at 7:30 tomorrow night, but baseball fans know better. That game will be later than 7:30 tomorrow, and the Citadel will be playing for their season. So we're in Greenville, coming to you from the road for the Southern Conference Baseball Tournament, and I love this area. Nice to be able to spend a couple of days here. Unfortunately, today's a bit of a washout, but we'll get out there after talking some sports for the next few hours. All right, let me start with this. With the NBA playoffs, and as Trent mentioned, is Miami Heat falling behind now after that game last night against the Celtics. And I think last night was almost like the NBA gods almost like punishing us in a certain way, where it was actually a competitive game for a while, at least the first half. But it was such a hard game to watch. It was like 40-40 at halftime, right? And it was competitive. And it was almost like those hearing the complaints of NBA fans with all these blowouts and saying, all right, we'll give you a close game, but it's not going to be very interesting to watch. Right? Careful what you wish for. You want a close game, it won't be very high scoring. And that was ugly last night for a long time. Then the Celtics came out in the second half, poured it on Miami, pulled away, and a big win for Boston now going back home, up 3-2. And if you've been watching this series, you just don't feel good about the Heat and the way they've been playing. Most notably, Jimmy Butler just isn't the same guy. He hasn't been good the last three games. He's clearly not 100%, and that's the big issue. When I look at this Heat team, I'm going to make two comparisons. The first one is to the New England Patriots, in the sense that with the Patriots, and you can even compare it to Nick Saban, any great coach, any great company that has a great CEO, take anything in life that has somebody great at the top. Because when you have a great boss, or you have a great coach, or even a great GM, whoever you think the leader is of a certain organization, you could fill in the rest underneath them. It doesn't matter. They're going to get the most out of them. You ever work for a great boss, right, where everybody that came into the company was successful or were good at what they had to do? They were put in position to succeed, which is really the sign of, I think, a great leader. That's the idea of a coach. You obviously can't go out there and make the plays, but can you put your players in the best position to succeed? And the best coaches do the best job. That's what coaching is. You can't go shoot the basket, but you have to put your guys in the best position to be able to make said basket. And the best coaches get the best out of their players. We see it a lot with great quarterbacks. Tom Brady would always make his wide receivers look better than they actually were, which is why when I think of the Heat, I think of the Patriots. Because whether it's Bill Belichick with his assistant coaches, or you can even say Tom Brady with his wide receivers, with his supporting cast, they leave New England not quite the same. How many coaches have flamed out when they've gone off on their own away from Bill Belichick? And then you realize, like, oh, actually, maybe it's just Bill that makes these guys look like great coaches or coordinators, make them look like they actually know what they're doing. And then you hire an Eric Mangini and a Romeo Crennel and a Charlie Weiss and Josh McDaniels the first time and Bill O'Brien. Name any coach. There hasn't been a good coach from the coaching tree of Belichick. Similar to Saban, his assistants have had a little more success, right? Lane Kiffin, technically, is now part of that tree. Now, he was the head coach before working for Saban, but he's been even better since leaving Saban. So there's been a few guys that have come, Mario Cristobal, right? There's been some guys that left Saban and have had success. Obviously, now you look at like a Kirby, a Jimbo. There's been plenty. But point being, when you have a Bill Belichick, when you have a Tom Brady, you take a wide receiver off the Patriots thinking, wow, that guy was really impressive. Actually, no, it was kind of Tom that made him look impressive, right? Aaron Rodgers makes his wide receivers look better. Jordy Nelson didn't do anything after leaving. Greg Jennings didn't do much. His career was never the same after leaving. Go back to Brett Favre, right? Javon Walker, his career ended after he left Green Bay, so on and so forth. I could give you countless examples. Peyton Manning, Brett Favre, Tom Brady, all the great quarterbacks make their wide receivers look better. Then you invest big money in said wide receiver. Turns out, actually, it was more about the situation, the system, the quarterback, than the actual guy. And so to bring this now all the way back to the Heat, The reason why I thought of this comparison as I was watching the game last night or thinking about Miami is because I think Pat Riley does such a great job. I mean, look at what Pat Riley's done in his career. Now, if you've been watching Winning Time on HBO, you would see the genesis, the start of Pat Riley and his career in the front office as a coach, eventually an executive, you know, when it started with the Lakers 40 years ago. But from the Lakers to the Knicks to really, I think most impressively, what he has done with the Heat over the past now, what, 25 years, however long he's been in Miami? First as a coach, executive, went back to the sidelines, running the organization. We played the clip last, a couple days ago, earlier this week, I guess, with Jermaine O'Neal talking about the 8% body fat. We always hear about the Heat culture. And that comes from the top. And it comes from Pat Riley. And I think if Pat Riley was somewhere other than Miami, you'd be hearing a lot more about him right now. He does not get a lot of credit. And I think it's because it's the Miami Heat. Right? A popular storyline, I think it's low-hanging fruit. But on ESPN all week, if you listen to the national radio shows, if you watch some of the TV shows, they've been intentionally tweaking Heat fans, trying to get a rise out of Heat fans. If you go online, you see a lot of people talking about the Celtics bias, the Boston bias of the national media. I think part of it is a little intentional to get a rise out of Heat fan to drum up some interest in a boring series. But I also think part of it is just that Miami, for as popular of a city as Miami is and as fun of a city, and they set movies there and you have Miami Vice and people go on vacation and you think of the wild times in Miami. When it comes to the sports teams, you know, the Dolphins, the Marlins, the Miami Heat, we look at them more of a smaller market, even though Miami's not a small market. But when it comes to their place in these leagues, the Heat don't carry the same interest as the Lakers or the Celtics. In fact, later on, when we get to the worst fan bases, we'll circle back to the Miami Heat. But there's the iconic story of Heat fans leaving in the NBA Finals. Ray Allen makes the shot, and they're all trying to get back into the building. They just don't carry the same weight. So my point being, on the national landscape, not as many people focus on a Miami Heat as a Celtics, a Lakers, even nowadays a Warriors. Pick your other favorite popular team, LeBron James, wherever he's playing, as opposed to Miami. And if Pat Riley was still in L.A. or New York or doing what he was doing with some other teams, you'd be hearing a lot more about him. But my point in all this rambling is that why I think Miami is similar to a Belichick or the Patriots is that you look at this team, it's really not that great. Jimmy Butler goes down with an injury. The other guys need to step up, and you're wondering, where are they? Bam's been lousy. Strus has been, he hasn't made a shot in two games. He's supposed to be your three-point specialist. You're paying another guy $90 million to sit on the bench and not do anything in the playoffs. And it's almost like the whole MacGyver thing, right? Putting it all together with shoestring and bubblegum and a paperclip. And then when your star, Jimmy Butler, goes down, you know, I'll compare another comparison. The San Antonio Spurs somewhat, where it was more about the team than the star, but then if you lost to Tim Duncan, if Kawhi Leonard in those later years was unavailable, if even a Ginobili, a Tony Parker, right, you take away one little piece, it's like a Jenga, you're playing Jenga, one of those Jenga towers, the whole thing's going to collapse. And so when Jimmy Butler's not 100% and you need other guys to step up, you realize, like, actually, these other role players, maybe not quite as good as we thought they were. Or this Heat team in general. I had a buddy text me last night during that game asking, and I've got a lot of texts like this from my friends watching these games. How are the Heat here? How have they won multiple games against the Celtics? How are they the best team in the league? And it's not to disrespect Miami, but I think it's more of a credit to the job done by Eric Spoelstra and Pat Riley. Right, when a team overachieves, I think that's the credit to the coach, to the front office, to those in charge. When a company seems to get the most out of its employees, you ever walk into a company and realize, like, how is this place successful? These guys, look at these guys. This is a motley crew running this place. But you get the most out of them because the boss, the CEO, those leading the company know what they're doing. It may not be an all-star cast, but when you put them together, right, it's a pretty good thing. Bill Belichick, with his assistants, they go off other places. You wonder, like, how did they seem like such great coaches. Well, maybe it was more about Bill. Tom Brady and his wide receivers, right? They seemed like they were really good in New England. Wes Welker, Julian Edelman, maybe it was more about the quarterback, the great quarterback they were playing with. And for the Miami Heat, maybe it's more about, at the very top, what Pat Riley, Eric Spoelstra has built, that you get the most out of these other guys. But when you need them most, they can't rise to that level to help you in a big spot. And the other comparison I'll make is also to the Dallas Mavericks. You know, as we looked at these final four teams, we looked at Dallas, and the idea was, well, the Mavericks, they have the best player, Luka Doncic, but they have nothing else around him. When I look at Miami, they're just like Dallas. They have Jimmy Butler. They don't have enough help around him. Joel Embiid tweeted last night something along the lines of, to paraphrase, like, man, the Heat really need a second star. Yeah, he's right. Jimmy Butler needs more help because the problem is he's not quite as good offensively as Luka Doncic. So the Mavericks, we know the issue for them. They don't have a good enough supporting cast, but at least they have a guy who I think will become the best player in the NBA. All due respect to Jimmy Butler, who I gave him his flowers over the past week. He's one of the best guys in the playoffs over the last couple years. But he's still not quite as good as Luka, and the supporting cast is not good enough either. So you're like Dallas, but with a less talented offensive star. Meanwhile, for the Celtics on the other side, man, Jaylen Brown has had some big games. Right, the Heat are waiting for a Bam, somebody to step up, and Bam did have that one big performance a couple of nights ago. But they're waiting for somebody else to help out a Butler. Where the Celtics, they're having that second guy play big. At times, even better than their first guy, Jason Tatum. Brown's been more impressive probably more often than Tatum has. And Tatum played really well in the second half. Right, he woke up, got the job done, helped the Celtics win a big game last night on the road. But when I look at Miami, I try to compare them to a couple different things. I think the culture they've built and the success, which comes from the top, is reminiscent of like a Patriots, of a great quarterback, of a company that maybe doesn't have a great staff of employees, but they have a really smart boss, CEO, good managers, that they know what they're doing. They get the most out of those people. And for Miami, same idea. This Heat roster, you put these guys on another team or you ask them to be a star of another team or even be that second guy on a great team, I don't know if they can do it. But it works in Miami because of what they've built from the top. And when we focus so much on the Mavericks and say, the Mavericks, they can't win once we got to these Final Four, the Mavericks had the largest odds to try to win the championship, right? Because, they're not a good team. All they have is Luka. Well, Miami kind of being exposed these last couple of games when Jimmy Butler's hurt, and boy, did he look bad last night because he's clearly not 100%. Right? When Butler can't carry the load and score 40 points, the Heat are even worse off than Dallas because at least Luka is a little more maybe dependable or just offensively gifted than a Jimmy Butler. Butler's better on the defensive end. He's maybe more well-rounded overall than a Luka. But when it comes to having to score the basket, right, the Heat don't have a Luka to rely on, and they don't have really anybody else to help. Here was Stephen A. Smith on SportsCenter last night after the game when he was really laying into the Heat with their embarrassing effort at home last night in the biggest game of the year. And let's see. Hold on. When I'm on the road like this, we'll take you behind the radio scenes. When I'm on the road like this, I play the audio myself here in person from my setup because it's just easier that way than if I was in studio. And, of course, the first time, it never works properly. Let's try it a second time, see if we can get Stephen A. Smith here talking after the game last night. Well, I'm still not hearing anything on my end, so we'll effort that, and we'll figure it out. Point being, Stephen A., the best line that he said was the Heat looked like construction workers last night with all of their bricks. It was that kind of night for the Heat at home in a big game. I'll try to bring back that audio from Stephen A. But a tough night for the Heat last night, and the Celtics may have the series wrapped up at home in Game 6. By the way, now I've seen some data, right? It felt like this NBA playoffs has been so poor. Well, I've actually seen some data. The Athletic did a good piece this morning breaking it down, and based off of the final scores and the blowouts and the non-competitive games, based off of the data, this is the least competitive postseason we've had in the NBA since 2004. Not great. And after 2004, here's the irony. After that 2004 postseason, that was the Lakers won the finals once again. The Lakers didn't. That was the Pistons. Right, and the Pistons were a defensive team, and if you go back and you look at the final scores of the NBA Finals, they were all like in the 80s and the 70s. It was a very defensive game. It was a physical game. It was brutal. And so the NBA, after that postseason, changed the rules to remove hand-checking. Now, growing up, my father would yell at the TV for nothing more than hand-checking, right? Or when we would go to games, we'd go to my brother's games. Even if I was playing, my father always coached us growing up, yelling at the refs to not allow hand-checking. Because back in the day, hand-checking was never a thing. And I could tell you, I tell you all the time about my adventures going to play pickup hoops on Wednesday night like anybody actually cares. But it is always the worst when you play against somebody who's maybe a little out of shape, maybe wasn't a basketball player, can't really stay in front of you, and they're all physical with their hand-checking you, and even more than that. Right, but they're all over you. But there is nothing more frustrating because you don't want to be the guy always calling fouls. I never call fouls. Even if I get hacked, I will never call a foul in the pickup court. Because I'm not too soft. I hate the guy always calling their own fouls whenever they try to attempt a shot. So I don't do it. But I hate being guarded by somebody who they have their hands all over you. There's nothing worse than playing basketball and being defended by a guy who's, hacking you the whole time. But with that said, maybe hand-checking should come back to the NBA. I heard an interesting conversation with Nick Nurse, head coach of the Raptors, who was talking, not necessarily saying hand-checking should come back to the league, but laying out the idea of with removing hand-checking, it allows guards to get into the paint easier. It's harder to stay in front of these quick guards. And what that does is the defense then has to collapse, and it leads to the kick out to open threes, more three-pointers. Now, I've given you my theories why we've had so many blowouts in this NBA playoffs, and I've given you the five-layered theory. I have five different things. But I think the main one is simply three-pointers, the increase in how many threes these teams shoot. And so when you remove hand-checking, it allows guys to get into the lane easier, kick it out for more open threes. More threes are being shot. And the second part of it as well is that it leads to a Ja Morant being second in the league in points in the paint. But what it also leads is to Ja Morant taking a beating. And when you get to the playoffs, Ja Morant's injured. Devin Booker gets injured. Now Jimmy Butler's injured. You have these guards that are going into the lane, driving in amongst the trees, taking a bigger pounding, and it wears them down. Maybe you'd rather have them healthier. And it's almost it sounds counterintuitive to bring hand-checking back to the NBA and try to keep these guards out of the lane or getting to the rim, but it could keep them healthier. Maybe it cuts down on so many threes. Maybe a little bit more of a pull-up game comes back. I hate hand-checking when I play basketball. I always remember, growing up, my father always yelling about hand-checking. He hates watching it in the game. But when they removed it after 2004, after the last time the playoffs were this bad, right, they removed hand-checking. And it's changed the game. So too have analytics, the increase of three-pointers, higher scoring games. That's what the league wants. But oddly enough, we've had the worst postseason since they've removed hand-checking. And maybe allowing hand-checking again, maybe that could actually be the answer or help curb some of this stuff. If you don't like the direction the game's going with all these threes, maybe in the NBA, if you allow the defender to put a hand on a guy, right, maybe that would change some things, cut down on those threes. Or maybe we're just too far gone at this point with the analytics that teams are never going to turn back. And just constantly shoot threes all game. The Heat last night couldn't throw it in the ocean, especially from downtown. Hey, when we come back, speaking of the NBA, the All-NBA team was announced since we were last on air. I have a few thoughts, and plus what it may mean for the future of the NBA. We'll get to that when we come back. It's the Mara Midday Show, right here on ESPN Radio.
Spend lunch with Luke.
Attention campers, lunch has been canceled today due to lack of hustle. Deal with it.
On the Morrow Midday Show.
Who needs a house out in Hackensack? Is that all you get for your money? And it seems such a waste of time. If that's what it's all about, Mama, if that's moving up, then I'm moving out.
It's the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. Coming up, the All-NBA team was announced since we were last on air, and I got some thoughts on it and what it may mean for the league moving forward. We'll get to that here on the Morrow Midday Show. Plus, some thoughts coming up on Arch Manning as well. Now, we opened the show talking about the Miami Heat losing last night to the Celtics and how the Heat remind me of some other teams, players, leagues into the in the sports world. I was trying to play the Stephen A. clip. Now, just to try to, you know, you always have to pay off a tease in the radio business. So I think I've gotten the system working where I can play audio today. So to pay off, you know, because I tried to provide it, never happened. So let's circle back and see if I could get the Stephen A. audio when his comments on SportsCenter last night after the Heat lost against the Celtics.
One of the most terrific offensive performances you've seen. That's really what this comes down to. The Boston Celtics are an elite defensive team. We get all of that. But I will remind you that Max Strus, somebody that we've been raving about for the most part in the regular season because of his sharpshooting ability, this is a guy that went 0 for 9 today. Yep. He's 0 for 16 in the last two games. I actually had to look up his resume because I had to remember that he came from DePaul because he looked like he belongs back in college, that he ain't ready for this level because that's how bad he was. You look at Kyle Lowry, yeah, he was 0 for 6, but we all know he's hobbled. We all know he's lucky to see him out here because he's got a bad hamstring injury. But with Tyler Hero out due to his hamstring injury, he had to try and give you all that he could, but he just didn't have it. Oladipo, an offensive weapon throughout this series. He shoots 1-for-7 from the field tonight. Jimmy Butler, clearly hobbled by his knee injury, had no lift whatsoever, went out there and tried to give you his all, but shot 4-of-18 from the field. I don't care who you are. I don't care how great or putrid your defense is. If you can't make shots, anybody can beat you. And that was the Miami Heat tonight. They resembled a bunch of construction workers looking like they're throwing bricks all over the damn place. And that is why the Miami Heat are going to Boston, getting set to be eliminated from the Eastern Conference Finals this Friday night. My reservations are already made. I ain't coming back to Miami.
Yeah, rightfully so. Now, Stephen A. could be a bit much at times, but I think that's when he's at his best, is when he's laying into somebody, as he was with the Miami Heat after that performance last night. I told you before the start of the series that I thought the Celtics would win in six, and I feel good about that. I think the Celtics will win this series in six games. Now, the NBA also announced the All-NBA team. On the first team, what's interesting is first-team All-NBA, all five guys are 27 or younger, and it does not include LeBron. It does not include Kevin Durant. It does not include Steph Curry. In fact, it's the first time since 2007 that the first-team All-NBA does not include any of those three guys. And it's this changing of the guard we've been talking about in the NBA, and it's a good thing for the league. The five guys that are on the All-NBA, the first team, and of course you have to go by position, right? So you have a point guard, a shooting guard, small forward, power forward, center, yada, yada, yada. So the five guys, you have Jokic, MVP, 27 years old. You have Giannis, right, already multiple-time MVP, 27 years old. You have Luka Doncic, only 23 years old. Soon, I imagine, will be an MVP. And then you have the two guards, the two other guards, Jason Tatum at 24 years old, and Devin Booker, 25. Now, all five made it to the playoffs this year, right? Obviously, a couple of them still playing. A couple of them have been MVP players. A couple of them have been on teams that have the best record in the league. One so far has won already a championship. These are the top five players in the NBA this past year. All 27 or younger. Doesn't include LeBron, Durant, or Curry. Also doesn't include Ja Morant. Didn't make the first team, and he's a very talented young player. Zion Williamson, we thought would be on a list like this by now, hasn't been able to get on the floor. So if he can figure out his health situation or his weight or whatever, his foot issues, right, he's another guy to watch. The point being, there's so much young talent in the NBA that the league does not have to solely just rely on Curry and LeBron, like when they were squaring off in the NBA Finals four straight years not too long ago. A couple of things that stand out, though, other than just the fact that this is good for the NBA, that the best players are this young and they're kind of new faces, right, new names. They're mostly on teams that aren't used to winning. Now, remove Jason Tatum, who's on the Celtics. Of course, the Celtics, they're right there with the Lakers, right, when you talk about the two most successful franchises. However, the Celtics have only won one championship in the last, I think it's 35 years now. So even though they have that history and tradition, more recently, they haven't been all that successful in winning. But let's take away the Celtics because they're one of those franchises that you're used to seeing them win, even if it was back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. Otherwise, the other four guys, you got the Nuggets, the Bucks, the Mavericks, the Suns. Now, the Bucks, of course, just won, but because of Giannis. And that was their first championship since some guy named Lou Alcindor played there. The Nuggets, right, still looking for that elusive championship. The Suns, same idea, still looking for that first. And the Dallas Mavericks, you have to go back about 13 years, maybe a decade, with Dirk Nowitzki going up against LeBron and the Heat. But the Mavericks just don't really have that history of winning a bunch of championships. In fact, that really seemed like the outlier. It was such a surprise that Dirk and Dallas was able to get it done. So it's not the same old players. It's not the same old teams. Not LeBron and Durant and all around, you know, the Knicks and the Lakers and the Celtics and the same teams you always hear about. No, the best players in the league are young guys that have just come in the league the past few years, and they're on these teams that we're not used to seeing in that top conversation year in and year out. The Nuggets, the Bucks, the Mavericks, the Suns, and this is good for the league. This is what we've been clamoring about, right? Having more parity, having more fan bases be interested, not having all the teams all the stars team up, having them play for different teams, and it's reminiscent of the 1970s in the NBA. Now, most people will say, well, that's not a good thing. Right, Magic and Bird had to come in 79 and save the NBA because the 70s were so bad. But it was a different time. It's a different world now. Back in the 70s, there wasn't a dearth of talent. There were no dynasties. But think back to the top players of the 70s. Right, there was a lot of talent, a lot of Hall of Famers. I mean, you had great players in the 70s. Clyde Frazier, Rick Barry, Bill Walton, Dr. J, Kareem, Elvin Hayes, Jerry West, Artis Gilmore, Bob McAdoo, Bob Lanier, who unfortunately just passed away, so on and so forth. I could go on and on. A lot of talent in the 70s. They were just mostly on separate teams. Gave us unique champions. But the NBA was different. I mean, we just celebrated the 75th year of the NBA. So now think back to the 70s. I mean, I don't want to make you feel old if you grew up watching those guys, but that was 50 years ago. So the NBA was still, when we started the 70s, the NBA was less than 25 years old. It was a different world, a different era, a different league. There wasn't, you know, all the games on TV. There wasn't the ability to watch any team you wanted. There wasn't as many teams in the league. There weren't people going to the games. They weren't making as much money. Guys weren't getting paid as much. There was no internet. None of that stuff. It's a different world now. So people will point to the 70s NBA and say, oh, that's not a good thing. You compare today to the 70s, that's terrible. The NBA almost went bankrupt. It was different back then. Now, the NBA is built up that just because there's no super teams, don't think that suddenly the NBA is going to fail. When Nick Saban retires from Alabama, don't think that college football is suddenly going to fall off the table. Like, oh, no, we don't have the dynasty. We don't have the super team of Alabama. What's college football going to? Don't worry. College football will be just fine. Right? The NFL, we broke up the Patriots. They're doing okay, the NFL. It's a different world nowadays where you don't need these dynasties. You don't need those stars, Magic and Bird, to try to save the league. The league is just fine. It doesn't need saving. You had a bad commissioner back then. They didn't have the same revenue, didn't have the same resources or just the built-up fan base like you do now. But you also don't have the dynasties of the last 40 years. I think that's great for the league. And then a couple last things. The one big difference from the league now when it comes to the players compared to the 70s, international players. I mean, there were no international players in the 70s. That didn't really start until the last 30 years. And you look at the league now. On the All-NBA, the first team, you have Jokic, Giannis, and Luka, three international players. Embiid is on the second team, international player who is in the MVP running this year. Some of the best players in the league are from other countries. And that's big for the NBA, too, that not only will you get great players here from the States, but now other countries are developing some of the best basketball talent in the world, and it just adds to the level of talent overall in the league. You can pluck from all these other countries that are giving you not only just like solid options, but great options. You go get an Embiid. You get a Luka Doncic. Luka Doncic comes in. He's 23 years old. He's already one of the best players in the league. Right. So now you add the international players as well, and it gives you a deeper pool of talent in the NBA. I think the NBA is in a great spot. This postseason has been pretty horrendous. I'm not going to lie. Right. All the blowouts. It's been the least competitive playoffs in almost 20 years. But for the future of the NBA, you got a lot of young talent spread throughout the league at teams that aren't used to winning. It's going to revitalize those fan bases. I think it's good to see. Now the question, who will have the best career? Right, the first team All-NBA, they're all five guys are 27 or younger. Which one of those five will be the best? Jokic, Giannis, Luka, Tatum, Booker. I think it comes down to three. I remove Jokic. Jokic is great. He was my vote for MVP this year. He should have won the award. I think Jokic is a great talent. I just worry about him in Denver with the pieces around him or lack thereof. And then also just the fact that nowadays a big guy can't carry the team themselves. And we saw that in the postseason this year. Jokic could be as good as he is, but he's going to need enough help around him. I don't know if you get that in Denver. So I think he's going to have a really good career, but he's going to be overshadowed by some other guys and their accomplishments. I removed Devin Booker as well. I just don't think Devin Booker's on the same level. He was really disappointing in the postseason this year where he faded after mocking Luka, and then Luka embarrassed those guys. And the Suns, you know, they needed Chris Paul to come in, help them have success the last couple of years. Booker, I don't think he's at that point yet like some of these other guys. But Tatum, Giannis, Luka. Now, Tatum needs to be included because he's on the Celtics. He'll always be competitive. He'll have a chance to win some titles in his career. And we know championships are so important. He's already been to the Eastern Conference Finals three times in the last 5 years. He'll be there some more. So just from always playing in the postseason, playing in big games, he'll have a chance to win some rings, maybe one this year. We'll look back at Tatum as having quite the career, even if I think he's a little too inconsistent right now to be considered one of the best players in the league. Giannis, of course, right? He's already considered the best player in the league. Already has a championship, has multiple MVPs. I don't think he's done just yet. So he's on his way to having a legendary career. And then Luka's the other one as well. Because I think Luka, it's a safe bet. See if a sports book will take it. I think he'll win an MVP fairly soon. I think he wins a couple of MVPs before his career is done. And I think he'll become the best player in the league. Will he win a championship? I don't know. Because it's not that easy in Dallas for whatever reason. They've never been able to attract talent there. I don't know why. You have Mark Cuban. You have deep pockets. You have Texas is a friendly place to live in terms of, you know, people are moving there because of the taxes, right, getting out of California. You're in the middle of the state, so travel isn't bad in the NBA. It's in terms of the weather during a winter league like the NBA, right, there's a lot of pros to playing for the Mavericks, and yet they can never get the guys. I don't know if they could build a team around Luka, but just watching him, you know, he has the ability. He's going to be one of the greatest players of the next, over the next 20 years. Those are the three guys to me that when I look at this All-NBA team and the new young stars of the NBA, Tatum, Giannis, and Luka, I think will be the main three that can carry the league moving forward. Tatum, because he's on the Celtics, and the Celtics are always relevant and interesting, and you want them to be. Giannis, because, I mean, he's already the best player in the league. And Luka, because I think in short order, he'll become the best player in the league. And boy, is he fun to watch. The NBA, though, certainly in good hands. A lot of young talent that can carry this league moving forward. It's not just the same old, right? It's not just LeBron and Durant and Steph Curry. I mean, Curry is still, he's going to be in the NBA Finals this year, but a lot of good young talent along with him as well. When we come back, speaking of young talent, Arch Manning. It's the big story in college football. Not only name, image, and likeness, but everybody waiting to see what school Manning picks. Reports are he's narrowed it down to three. I'll tell you why he should narrow it down to one. I'll tell you what school he should pick. Unfortunately, the school is not based in this in the state of South Carolina. But Arch Manning, where should he go? What's he going to do? I'll tell you at least who he should pick when we come back. It's the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Now back to the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
In the heartland. Jackie gonna be a football star. Diane's debutante backseat of Jackie's car. Sucking on chili dog, outside taste freeze.
Where should Arch Manning go? I'll let you know in just a moment here on the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow on ESPN Radio. As we have, you know, there's a couple of things. There's the big story that everyone's following, of course, name, image, and likeness in college sports. And then there's the big story that everyone's tracking that we'll actually get some resolution on. I don't know if anything's going to change with name, image, and likeness anytime soon. But I do know we're going to get some clarity on Arch Manning. Now, the reports are that he's narrowed it down to three schools. Georgia, Alabama, and Texas. Those are the three to make the cut. I'll tell you, of those three, if I was Arch Manning, who I would choose. And it would be Georgia. Now let's go one by one. Alabama just signed a five-star quarterback in the same class. They just got a commit from, his name is Eli Holstein. He's a four-star quarterback, excuse me. But still, he was one of the top quarterbacks in the class from Louisiana. Now, if you're Arch Manning, right, I don't know if you're turned off by competition. I think that's what makes all these guys great is that they don't run from competition. They're not afraid of competition. They're talented enough, confident enough that they could beat anybody. But with that said, you rarely see two top quarterbacks go to the same school in the same class. I was trying to think of the last time it happened. If there's a more recent example, please let me know. You can get to me on Twitter. You can send a message online, charlestonsportsradio.com. You could call the show. The last one I could think of was actually 2007. I think it's been 15 years since the same school brought in top quarterbacks in the same class. And that was when Florida brought in John Brantley and Cam Newton. But if you recall, Brantley was originally going to Texas, another school we'll talk about in just a moment. And then he decommitted and went to Florida because there's a family connection. His father went there. His father was a fan. He ended up in Florida. Cam Newton ends up beating him out. Then, you know, the rest is history. Cam Newton has to leave Florida. Got into some trouble. Brantley stays, yada, yada, yada. But it's not often that you see because only one can play. And especially nowadays with the transfer portal, right, where guys run away from that competition for an easier landing where they can go play right away, would you have two quarterbacks go to the same school at the same time when they're going to be in the same class? And, hey, if things work out, we'll be here, right? Our careers are 4 years long, maybe three. We'll both be here for the next 3 years, right? We're going to compete. Only one of us is going to actually play. It can be a turnoff. I think it's been about 15 years since a school actually was able to accomplish that. Have two top quarterbacks come in and battle it out. And for those at Florida, that was for the backup spot. You know, Cam Newton originally won the battle, lost the war, you could say, because he didn't stay at Florida his whole career. Brantley stayed longer. But not often do you see one quarterback commits and then another top quarterback says, yeah, you know what, I do want to go there and compete with this other guy every year of my career. When you're being wooed as a recruit, You want them to roll out the red carpet and throw the flag. You don't want to have another guy there that you're trying to compete with. You want to be given the job. Come in. And maybe not your freshman year, but you know, like, yeah, after this guy leaves, right, I'm the star. They're building around me. And other schools will offer you that opportunity. So Alabama seems like the why not go play for Saban, and the way they're putting quarterbacks in the league lately, and go play for Saban and Alabama and try to win another national championship with the talent around you in the SEC. And maybe it's the other quarterback that should be more concerned as opposed to Arch Manning. But it's just I'm just going off of history. Not often do you see one top quarterback commit and then a second still commit to that same school. Because usually you want to be the guy. You don't want to be competing with another the guy for your role throughout your career. Then you get to Texas. Steve Sarkisian, who reportedly has a great relationship with the Manning family. You have Texas, who will be in the SEC soon, and it seems like that's the driving force. The Manning family, obviously, they're SEC all the way. And so from the beginning of this whole thing, it seems like Arch was only interested in playing in the SEC. Clemson was the one exception. And Clemson hasn't really made it as far as maybe some people thought they would in this whole process. But the concern with Texas is while Sarkisian may be interesting to go play for, an interesting offensive coach, I don't think Texas is set up to succeed at least immediately when they join the SEC. And you're going to go in with a bunch of Big 12 linemen to try to compete with SEC linemen, right? And there's a big difference between those two conferences. So as soon, they're going to have to try to alter their recruiting Texas if they haven't already. You're going to roll into the SEC and not be on the same footing, no pun intended, but not even at lineman, just with everything, with your talent base, with the type of bodies you have, with even just the schedule you've been playing, what you've been preparing for. You roll into the SEC, and it makes it more difficult. So you're going to go in already kind of behind the eight ball. If you want to go play in the SEC, like if that's the main reason, or maybe it's just because Sarkisian, but I would go to a school that's been in the SEC for a long time and is already set up to succeed in that conference or has shown success. And as interesting of an offensive play caller Sarkisian may believe to be, as a head coach, he hasn't been all that successful. We'll see how he does with Texas this year. Money could be a big driving force to go play at Texas, but you know, the Manning family, they're not concerned about money. They're doing just fine. And then that leads me to Georgia. I would pick Georgia. Now, look, they're defending national champs, and I know Arch isn't coming in to play September. But you just saw them win a national championship. And I think to G.G. Jackson, right, choosing UNC, we were talking about at the time, you watch UNC go all the way to the national championship, that's just a more interesting draw. Plus, Georgia had a historic defense. Maybe they won't have the same type of defense in the near future, but you see what they're capable of. And they just won a national championship with Stetson Bennett. Arch Manning, on paper, is a lot better than Stetson Bennett. If they could win with Stetson Bennett because of that defense, and Kirby Smart is the mastermind behind the defense, and he's still going to be there, right? Then imagine what they could try to do with an Arch Manning and a defense of that level, or at least close to it. It's hard to expect the Georgia defense to be that good year after year after year. But they've always had a good defense. They've been led by their defense. That's Kirby Smart's specialty. That's the head coach that you have. That's what you're going to continue to have. It's going to be a defensive-driven team, and if you add Arch Manning to the mix, right, that'd be really interesting. If I'm Arch Manning right now, if I'm looking at those three teams, I put Georgia first, and I would put Texas last. But Alabama, like, they just got another quarterback. And maybe Arch is the more talented quarterback, and right, maybe he shouldn't be concerned about competition. But we just don't see it happen very often. Texas, I would not want to be on Texas immediately coming into the SEC. I don't think that puts you in the best position to succeed. I think it kind of does the opposite. Makes it harder on yourself. But Georgia just won a national championship with Stetson Bennett. Imagine what they could do with an Arch Manning. Now, when it comes to Arch Manning and what to expect out of him, here is Jake Crane, who was on the airwaves earlier this morning on the Scott Hamilton Show, part of Crane and Company, talking about the expectations of an Arch Manning. What should we expect? What's Arch going to look like? Here is Jake talking about it.
It's going to be nearly impossible for him to reach the heights of these expectations. He'll be expected to win a Natty very early, win the Heisman. We've seen young guys win it before. Then, if he does make the NFL, he'll be expected to be the next superstar. The odds say that goal isn't most likely. How many times have we seen megastars and mega sports stars' children have the same or more success than their predecessor? We usually don't. Michael Jordan's kid was never going to be Michael Jordan. Bronny most likely won't be LeBron. I can go down the list. And that's not to say that Arch won't be elite. He just won't be perfect. Some are already calling him generational or the next Tom Brady. Let's let the kid pick a school first. Let's let him get used to the college life and the responsibilities of being a student athlete. He may even reach these lofty expectations. He has the ability to, but the odds aren't in his favor. They're not in anybody's favor. I'm excited as hell to watch him play. wherever he ends up choosing to go. But let's let him write his own story before we start selling his book.
Jay Crane on Arch Manning. And while it is true, right, the Suns rarely live up to the same standard. We know the kids that have been better, Barry Bonds, Ken Griffey Jr., were better. But while their fathers were good athletes, they weren't necessarily the stars of a LeBron, a Michael Jordan, or in this case, the uncle, Peyton Manning, or even an Eli Manning. Those are what you have to live up to. And the expectations, I said the same thing about Trevor Lawrence, right? It's not Lawrence setting the expectations. It's not fair to Trevor Lawrence. It's us setting the expectations. But still, those are the expectations you then have to live up to. That's the standard set for you. And for Arch, what an almost impossibly high standard to try to live up to. But that's what he's going to be tasked to do. It won't be easy, but I think your best shot may be with Georgia. I think your worst shot is with Texas. We'll wrap up hour one when we come back. It's the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Now back to the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Doing your own. Well, don't you worry, baby, don't worry, because I'm right here, right here, right here, right here at home. Because I'm a picker, I'm a grinner, I'm a lover, and I'm a sinner. I play my music in the sun.
Wrapping up hour one of the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. And unfortunately, some terrible news coming out this afternoon as Ray Liotta has passed away at the age of 67. He was filming a movie in the Dominican Republic and reportedly passed away in his sleep, 67 years old, originally from New Jersey. Now, his first like role where he got... I wouldn't say he got noticed, but now you look back at the time and you see like, oh, yeah, that's right. He was Shoeless Joe Jackson in Field of Dreams. And the iconic story, of course, is that he batted the wrong side. They were going to reverse it in post-production, and they just never did. Shoeless Joe, which actually the museum is right across from where I'm broadcasting right now. I can see it from out the window, the Shoeless Joe Jackson Museum. But he was a lefty. Liotta was a righty. And they said, it's okay, right? Seems like such a weird casting decision. They said, Ray, just you bat righty. They tried to turn him into a lefty hitter. It was too challenging. They said, just bat righty. We'll flip it. We'll mirror the image in post-production. And then when Liotta watched the film afterwards, like at the premiere, he saw that they never flipped it. So in the movie Field of Dreams, Shoeless Joe is played by Ray Liotta, and he's a righty when really he's supposed to be a lefty. Then right after that, of course, he did Goodfellas, my favorite movie of all time. And unfortunately, Liotta, who's been in everything, he's been in every movie of the last 30 years. Unfortunately, he passed away at 67. So sad news out of Hollywood this morning. I got more thoughts on Liotta's career. I think it's fascinating. Plus, we'll get to name, image, likeness, and Javon Kinlaw next as well. Hour two coming up. It's the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.